here at Sharp Facets Gallery, and today I am very privileged to have the Lieutenant Governor, Glenn McConnell, sitting right here with me across the table. We're going to be talking about senior issues. We're going to be talking a little bit about him and his background, and I certainly hope you're going to enjoy it. If you've got a question for our Lieutenant Governor, don't hesitate to give us a call, 229-7984. That's 229-7984. Well, Lieutenant Governor Glenn McConnell, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, thank you, and glad to be here with you.
Absolutely. Now, you've had a busy day today.
Very much so. Very much so. We've been quite a distance today, and we've had an interesting chance to look and see different ways that senior services are provided, go into seniors' homes where meals are delivered, talk to them, see the challenges they face, and see part of the great challenge coming for the state of South Carolina.
It is a challenge, isn't it, because so much of our state is rural.
That is correct, and rural areas have different needs than urban areas. And, for instance, transportation becomes a very important thing. In rural areas, people tend to have to work in the big cities. The result is they have challenges for their children and for the loved ones who are challenged themselves, and they have challenged adults or adult children. And transportation, adult daycare, becomes essential in those particular places.
Sure.
Urban areas, it can change the fabric of what is the most pressing challenge for us with limited resources.
Sure, and of course, I was reading over some of the information, the masses of information that I've been reading here. It says that, of course, it's so much more economical to keep a senior in their home, and of course, they want to stay in their home, and that's a challenge, though, isn't it?
It is a challenge, and let me tell you, it becomes a greater challenge over the fact that the statistics indicate that we will, and I'm talking about we, I'm talking about us senior citizens, we are going to double in number over the next 20 years, from about 900,000 to almost 2 million. Then go back and look at the program that's been cut 48%, which is the program you alluded to in your question, which is allowing seniors to age with grace in their homes where they want to be. We can do it for about $1,000 a person. The alternative is some 50 times more expensive. And the point I make to the audience out there is as people roll through their assets, they'll end up on Medicaid and in Medicaid beds. The taxpayer is going to end up footing part of the bill. If we can break the migration and slow it down to those nursing beds and to the exhaustion of people's assets and things, then we're able to, I think, break the budget buster. And when you know the population's going to double, there is no strategy to deal with it. And yet we have dwindling resources, and we're struggling to deal with the problem we have today. And that indicates you got to stop and think about a new strategic plan and a new way to do it. You cannot expect a different result by doing the same thing. But I want to go back one point I want to make time and time again to your listening audience. Talk to the seniors. They've paid their dues. They've helped society get where it is. They're not looking for handouts. They're only looking for a helping hand.
Absolutely. And I think you couldn't be more right about that. And, of course, you know, for you, this has been a – you were a senator. You had to ascend to this office of lieutenant governor. It was a hard decision. I know you're a Constitution guy, so I know that was something that you felt was the right thing to do. But it was tough, wasn't it?
It was tough. I had spent I never tried to run for Congress or higher office. I stayed right in Charleston, and I became a senior senator. I moved up to chairman of the Judiciary Committee, most powerful committee in the Senate. I became the president pro tempore of the South Carolina Senate and was living my political dream. I'd amassed over $500,000 in reelection funds over the 30 years, and my polls indicated that I would be a shoe-in for another term. Then the lieutenant governor got in trouble. The dilemma for me was this. The political consultant said, protect yourself, protect your seniority, resign, then let him elect a new president pro tem, and then after he ascends to the lieutenant governorship, then just run for reelection as the senator for District 41. There's a couple of problems with that. One is you take an oath of office, you put your hand on the Bible, you swear to Almighty God, you bring him into the equation. How could I do that and violate my oath, number one? Number two, the problem I had was I was always about not trying to get around constitutions and construe them and contort them. And here I was, tempted with power. And the question was, do I remain true to my word and protect my conscience or sell myself to power? And I stepped up and did it. And let me say, on the day I did it and spoke, I felt almost like, oh, it was sad for me. I mean, there my whole political career. But the next day, I sat down with Mr. Kester to find out about the program on aging. And then I started getting immersed into that. And I look back now, and I'm enjoying tackling this issue. And so maybe in that loss and, shall I say, the compliance with the Constitution, I got a gain out of it. I really am picked up and energized by what I see with seniors, what seniors are doing for seniors, the challenge ahead. And so maybe I should say that I'm fortunate that I'm placed in the position to have an opportunity to make a difference on that issue.
Well, you know, it has to be kind of freeing in some aspects with all the judicial and all the wrangling and everything down there in the House and the Senate and everything. It has to be in some aspects kind of freeing.
Well, it was stressful where we were. As President Pro Tem, I had all the legal suits, everything, Chairman of Judiciary with the most workload. And so I have put that. I'm able to concentrate on a very single subject at this particular time, and this is an issue which will overwhelm the state if we don't come up with a strategy. So, yes, on one hand, it's relieving. On the other, I'm having to go learn a whole bunch of stuff that I never learned over 31 years because the Office on Aging was a line item, and we didn't get very deep into it. But when I see what they've done, when I see the seniors who the smiles on their face when they see that meal a day because they can't
Absolutely.
Cook,
yeah.
When I see the heartwarming stories that I'm hearing of the great things that are done out there, it's a gratifying situation, and I count myself now as, maybe I was fortunate that I was there, and maybe because I know most of those people that are there, I can put a face on the issue of aging, take it back to them, and sell that General Assembly and reverse some of what occurred.
Haven't you already done that?
I hope so. I've already started.
Didn't I read something about some money that you got back coming back there? Yes.
Yeah, let me tell you two things we encountered. Immediately when I got in there, I found out that the Lieutenant Governor's office budget had been vetoed, and it wasn't placed back. Yet you had the constitutional requirement to spend the money and do the things. And so when I talked to Mr. Kester, I found out we were his office, the Office on Aging, was supporting the Lieutenant Governor's office, whereas we should have been supporting the Office on Aging, which meant that money that should have gone for aging went to pay administrative fees. First thing I did was get the budget restored on the line. I got attacked claiming I had increased the budget, but what I really did was get the money back where it belonged. The second thing was he told me we had 8,000 people on a waiting list. 8,000. And to the audience out there, I'm talking about people that the difference in them being able to stay in their home and off of Medicaid and out of that Medicaid bed, which is going to get taxed to the taxpayer, is a meal a day, or it's a trip to a doctor, or it's some homemaker services because they're in a wheelchair and a walker and they can't clean their house and meet the requirements. But there are 8,000 people out there looking for that, that separates them from being able to stay home and age in grace. So I immediately went to work trying to get the money to close the waiting list. If you're 50 times cheaper, why would you cut that program? And so we were able to get
to... What was their answer, just out of curiosity?
Well,
what was the answer?
I didn't get much of an answer at this point, and that's why I'm out here. That's why I'm out here on this campaign of the Face on Aging, because next year I'm going to have some grassroots behind me.
Okay.
I'm going to have a silver hair legislature behind me. I'm going to have some legislators behind me. And we're going to stand up and demand that something be done. Let me tell your audience, let me give you one story. It's in another county, and I won't say which county. Our programs were delivering meals to seniors. These seniors were not flourishing, and they started wondering, what's wrong here? I want to indicate how desperate these people cling on to staying at home. And then we found the common denominator. The common denominator was they lived alone. They had no transportation to the supermarket. And they had a pet, their only companion. You can put together what was occurring. They were sharing that meal with their pet.
Absolutely.
And the volunteers over there, they raised a pet food drive to fill that void. But it ought to indicate to the audience, these are seniors who worked all their life. They're struggling. Some of them have adult children. I've met seniors who are trying to stay at home on walkers. Their son has had a stroke. They're taking care of him. I've met another one whose son died, and it was a single parent, and he's got his grandson, and he's 76 years old, and he's trying to make it at home. These are people aren't looking for handouts. They just need a little bit of help. That's what we're about. How do we as a people gracefully age, meet responsibilities, and not become dependent on the state?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And these are things that can be addressed. And, you know, and I think it's great from the Lieutenant Governor's office has the mouthpiece to be able to be out there doing this. So what other things are you looking at that can happen through the Lieutenant Governor's office?
Well, we're going to be, again, going back to this aging thing, I'm looking at where is there too much regulation? Where is it impractical?
Wait a minute. Where is there too much regulation? How long you got, Glenn?
Well, we could tell you where there wasn't enough regulation in another instance. And then we're looking at things like, can't we be looking at new things? I heard about a program today I really can't tell you much about until I study it called PACE. But so we're looking for new ideas. How do we share some of these ideas with other places? Then we're looking at getting alternatives in communities, adult daycare, home health, respite care. We got caregivers out there, hundreds of thousands of caregivers taking care of relatives with Alzheimer's. They just need an afternoon off or somewhere to take them while they go to run, maybe go to work, or maybe or just go to the grocery store or something. So we're looking at how do we create respite care. Then we got adult children whose families have kept them at home, and we've got to give them some alternatives to maintain their independence and not have to go into an institution.
The Burton Center works a lot with that. We have the Burton Center out here. It does a phenomenal job of working with people.
It's about. It's about just giving them a helping hand. We're looking at all of that. Then as I go every day, I go out on these tours, mm-hmm. I confront new problems. Let me tell you about one facility we ran into. This facility, it handles people who really have just enough money and are too healthy not to qualify for Medicaid, but they don't have enough money, and they have certain needs that need to be tended. They're in facilities, these residential care facilities. Mm-hmm. They're almost like boarding houses, some of them. And then we encounter one where they got a deteriorating ramp, and they get the volunteer help to fix the ramp, and then DHEC comes in there and tells them that's construction and they shouldn't have fixed the ramp. It gets so frustrating, and so those are things we're going to try to move some of those mountains and try to make some things happen.
Well, what's the number down there so people can start calling your office?
Well, I mean, that's a good question, I'll tell you. I'll give it to you right now. I mean,
okay.
they can call our office at 803-734-2080. But I just want to say, we're out there, we're looking at different things. As a lieutenant governor, my duty is also to preside over the Senate. And I can tell you, I told the senators, I held myself strictly to the Constitution, and I'm holding them the same way on my rulings. I don't care, my friends, Republican or Democrat, you will abide by the Constitution because, as you earlier mentioned, I am very constitutionalist, and I believe that the primary question in government, before you go to a policy and say, I would like to do this, you need to ask yourself, is it constitutional to do it?
Is it constitutional?
That's the frontline question, always should be.
Do they ask themselves a lot that down there? And, you know, we could talk a little about the federal government. Do you think they ask themselves that question up there?
Not always. In Washington?
In Washington.
I'm scared to think that that's just a fleeting moment. It very much concerns me the way they've trampled on the rights of the state. They pass unfunded mandates. They pass back all these regulations. Who would have ever conceived that the federal government would be involved in the things that it's in today? Freedom, to me, is very precious, and you should always err on the side that if there's doubt, you shouldn't do it on a constitutional basis. It was like when it just has to be the primary test. That's how you protect and limit government. Then I hear these people on both the federal and the state levels telling people, give them more power, and they'll give you an efficient government. That is a course in history people need to stop and think about. Power will corrupt. It will take your freedom. Barry Goldwater wrote a book called Conscience of a Conservative. He first said, you know, you should look at constitutionality. But he talked about the slippery slope. You will become comfortable with elected officials and think they are your guardians and your protectors. They'll do everything for you but protect your freedom before it's over, because the climate and the atmosphere is one of, we can do it in government. Just give us, trust us.
Actually, they say
power.
They can do it better, don't they?
Oh, they do. In a lot of instances, they say, we think we can do it better.
Exactly.
And that's not reality. And once those freedoms are gone, they're gone. Government creeps along, and over time, will take your freedom if you are not vigilant to it. And to get an efficient government, you don't get it by centralizing a given one person. You get it by exposing it. It's constant vigilance. It's constant oversight. I don't know how else to explain it to people. I have never seen in my 31 and a half years a naturally efficient government year to year. Just go, we've had some restructured agencies. HHS was a restructured agency. Did you know it ran a $222 million deficit over and above what the General Assembly had given them? And that agency was given to the governor. The previous governor had full authority over the agency. And then an audit comes out, and they don't even know from quarter to quarter where they were financially. And on top of that, the audit indicates that they were rolling a debt through their books.
How does that happen when you have a state that has a balanced budget?
That was my question. When I got the letter indicating there was a problem there, I wrote that agency head back, and I said, look, under our Constitution, you can't run a deficit. What do you mean last year's liability? I got back a 2.5-page attack letter about it. It's all the General Assembly's fault. Well, I went back and started looking at what they had asked for and what they were doing, and the audit has subsequently proven me true. Well, let me take you over a bookkeeping system I came across called SCIS. $140 million has been spent on this bookkeeping system. Yet, when I found it in the budget the previous year and asked about it, I was told, and I have the letter, we have spent $50 to $60 million on it. Then the Greenville News starts asking questions, and the price tag jumps to 84.8. Then I followed it up with a couple-of-page letter with about 20 questions, and 8 weeks later they admitted they had spent $140 million. If you got a space-age bookkeeping system that you spent $140 million for, how in the world could you not know how much it cost? Now, there's either some, yeah, I could give you what I think.
I've had Curtis Loftus, our state treasurer, on, and he's found some interesting things, too.
He has. He's been digging into the retirement system.
Yes.
I've been digging into that bookkeeping system because, let me tell you, that bookkeeping system is going to cost you, the taxpayer out there, $15 million a year to operate the system. And I've got list of consultants that have made hundreds of thousands of dollars for 10 months' worth of work on that system. And if that one isn't enough, let me take you over to DSS, where they were told by the federal government to have a child support enforcement system. Now, this is why I want to show you naturally efficient government. Did you know we're one of only about four states that has not complied with it? They have now racked up in expenses and fines for noncompliance almost $120 million.
How do we afford this, Glenn?
That somehow the money sloshes around like water in a bucket when they have to get it. But some of this was done through provisos and pulling money out to people. It never appeared some of this as a budget item, the ski system. Then I could take you over to another agency I had to get on, the Department of Revenue. They were trying to put a sales tax on the water that the lady poured on plants to water plants when you're only supposed to collect a sales tax on a tangible item. And that's where you got a government agency by regulation, by opinion, making laws without a vote of the elected officials, which brings me full circle to the aging question and what I'm talking. We need regulatory reform in this state. Right now, under South Carolina law, regulations go in effect 120 days after the agencies file them. I ask the listeners out there, Republican, Democrat, Independent, whatever, Have you seen government shrink over the last few decades? We have people telling you they create a leaner government, but you have an invisible growth in government through the regulatory process and the law to be changed. No regulation should go in effect charging you a fee or restricting what you do without an affirmative vote of the General Assembly. Then we would get some common sense in some of these regulations I'm dealing with on the question of seniors.
Absolutely. Now, let me ask you another question. In our federal government, we seem to be having issues of people working together. What about in South Carolina?
In my opinion, what has happened in American politics is sad, and that is that everything's about the next election. People, as soon as they get elected to one office, are running for another one. And the result is it's headlines, not headway.
Absolutely.
And so we don't have problem solutions. Instead, we have confrontations and one-liners put out there. And then you get gridlock. When I was president pro tem of the Senate, and I'm not patting myself on the back because the Democrats will tell you I'm a Republican, but I had the vote of every Democrat senator in the Senate. My predecessor was Senator John Drummond from right here.
Absolutely.
And Senator Drummond's a great man. He's my hero. He's the guy that helped train me, get me to think the way I do and how to handle the Senate. But Senator Drummond taught me that people should work together.
Well,
Senator Grassley taught me that, and we're losing that. It becomes partisan gridlock. It becomes the next election. It becomes the gotcha vote, and we got real problems. We don't have a strategic plan. We go double in population on seniors. Now's the time not to worry about the next election, but worry about next year. How are we going to begin putting a plan in place? And that, I guess, brings me back to the refreshing side. In a way of not serving in a Senate that was becoming more galvanized, is that I have a chance to work on a single issue. It shouldn't be a Republican issue. It shouldn't be a Democrat issue. It shouldn't be a liberal or conservative issue.
It's a people issue.
It's a people issue, and the people deserve a solution. And I'm going to try to do that. And maybe that'll help. But it's very frustrating, the gotcha politics that we have now in this country. We got real problems. Social Security system's in trouble. The country's in trouble. Look at the price of gasoline out there. You know, I don't understand what people don't understand about the economy. All of these politicians are promising jobs, and yeah, they can do some of it.
Mm-hmm.
But the real thing, those of us who are in the retail business, those of us who are out there in the economy, the price of gas is gobbling up people's discretionary income. It's causing them to have to spend less on stuff they otherwise would buy. They're not in the restaurants buying. They're buying less things in the grocery store. They're not in the gift shops buying. And they don't seem to get it in Washington. The price of gas is gutting and draining. It's like a giant vampire just sucking the life out of the American economy.
Absolutely. And yet in South Carolina, we have one of the lowest prices because of our gas taxes. Right.
But I can remember, I was in the retail business. I remember when it hit $3 a gallon. I remember I was in the ice cream business back then. I remember what happened. And I sit there hearing them. And like last night's debate was just incredible to me when the president said, well, the price of gas was $1.80 because the economy was down, but now the economy's up, the price of, that isn't it. He doesn't get it. You get the price of energy down and the economy will grow. You keep the price of power down in this country. Washington is forcing us to liquidate our coal plants and stuff before that we've used them and realized the base of the investment. The higher the price of energy goes, the less competitive we are in the world. All of us that are out there spending have less to spend. It means less jobs. I mean, it's the multiplier effect. I don't understand why they don't get that.
I don't either. This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. I am here with Lieutenant Governor Glenn McConnell. We're going to hear a quick word from our sponsors, Andy, and we'll be right back.
Gold, more precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood. Telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too. Paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
Thursday, Friday, happy day.
that's right. We're right back here at Sharp Facets Gallery. Gosh, you know, we got... Do you have any more staff at home, or is everybody with you here today?
Oh, some of them are back working.
Some are back there working?
Some of these folks are the folks that we that are out in the field. They know the people. For instance, I'll just say some of the people wonder, why are we coming? I guess they're worried we're doing a checkup or something. We're really there to find out, you know, how we can help them do the job, because they are fulfilling a need for people.
Sure.
So, and for us, it's a learning curve. And the other thing I'm trying to do is inject energy and optimism into our group. We got a big mission to do, and we got to do more with the few people we got.
Absolutely, you certainly do. Well, you know, we've had some questions come in since you and I started talking, and we've gotten a little wound up about politics and everything going on out there. We had a guy, Jake Sims, just called, and he said, whatever happened to Carol Campbell's idea of every department having the same system, and it was something that anyone could tell where the money was?
Well, we did have a STARS bookkeeping. It was a statewide bookkeeping system, and they had an agency system, but they've been converting over the last several years to SKEES. And the people I talk to say, that's not one you go take a dull pencil or anything and figure out what's going on. I go back to that audit. How could HHS run a $250 million deficit and then the audit indicate that they didn't know from quarter to quarter where they were with their annual budget, and yet they had this new space-age bookkeeping system? I'm telling you, I'm no fan of it, and, you know, common sense, it was the way it was handled and the way it was presented, and the more I dig into it, the more I dislike it.
Well, when did it come on, but when did you start changing to that?
They started changing it about 4 or 5 years ago, by my best recollection, but I stumbled on it in a proviso in the budget where they were giving the head of the Budget and Control Board the authority to go in there, and it said move not less than $4.7 million out of accounts to pay for SKEES. And I got up and I said, what is SKEES? Oh, it's a wonderful bookkeeping system. Well, then I started checking, oh, what did it cost? That's when the 50 to 60 million. Well, they couldn't even tell you. So wonderful that they couldn't even tell you that. How can you be $80 million off on the cost of what you're doing? And then, you know, the sad part was, this restructured agency, HHS, runs this giant deficit, and then the Budget and Control Board, it's like backing up a dump truck. They filled it full of the $222 million that they overspent, and the law said that they were supposed to find that it was beyond the agency's control. And I, my research draws me to a different conclusion and opinion.
So what does that mean going forward this year?
Well, for this year, I will continue to ask. There's some others that are interested in the SKEES, but for me, I've got to turn my attention to the seniors issue. I've got to do what I can to make sure that gets solved, but we have to develop a strategy. We got to energize the folks that are in it. I've seen some excitement here, for instance, in Greenwood. I'd like to get contagious in some other places across South Carolina. But we got to continue developing this plan. This is going to be a very large task for us, and that's where I'm going to have to focus on it.
Doesn't it go back to having money available, whether it's for the Department on Aging or any of these other things, that if you're finding waste in government or things that were overspent, that money could come back to agencies like this?
Well, this is...
Hello!
Yes, you just hit on a thing. An excellent point. How could we spend $140 million on this bookkeeping system and in the same breath cut a program by 48% that's 46 to 50 times, depending on whose figures you go by, cheaper and does what seniors want, allows them to remain in their home?
Sure.
Now, when I see stuff like that and I see stuff at DSS with these computers and stuff, you know, don't sit there and tell me that we didn't have the money. And that's why I go back to there is no such creature as a naturally occurring efficient government. They must be on constant vigil on them. And so, you know, the point I'm making to them is these people are out there. They've paid their dues. Why aren't we helping them? If we're able to slow down the migration, which we can do, we keep seniors in their home. We keep them out of nursing beds. We keep them out of emergency rooms. We keep them off of Medicaid. We lower the cost. It's a no-brainer. But instead, you know, right now they cut that 48% and then bail out HHS with a quarter of a billion. We asked for $5 million to start closing the waiting list, which is 8,000, and we have to scratch and crawl to get it.
Well, the one advantage that the Agency on Aging has is Lieutenant Governor Glenn McConnell, because, you know, as Ruth Adkins says here, what a deal. You would absolutely know where the bodies are buried with no obligations to apply, lest your focus can really produce advancements, okay, needed programs for the elderly. How about that?
Well, I really welcome her optimism that I can change it. I'm going to do my very best. I know the folks, and I'm going to them, and I hope the face on aging is like painting. It's painting a picture. It's going to have depth and dimension to it. It has many stories. It has suffering. It has excitement. It has sacrifice. It has sharing. It has all of the qualities. But it's a story that we can tell to the General Assembly, and with a little bit of help, we can move some mountains and break the budget busters up the road. And we've got to get people to understand the problem. We got to hopefully dig out all of these alternatives and strategies, and then we got to be able to portray it in a way that they will understand it and say, this is the way to go, and we need to change direction.
Well, you know, this is like history, isn't it? It is like history. When you look at the history, particularly of South Carolina and the struggles and everything that we have been through, to be able to put the face on it and put it together really will make a difference. So I think that's terrific. Now, what do you see as things that will be coming forward? Now, you've been doing this Face of Aging tour for a couple of
weeks. About 5 weeks now.
About 5 weeks. And have you gotten some good ideas on how you're going to make this program come together? I'm kind of asking like your five, like maybe Mitt Romney has five steps and the president says he only has one, you know,
right,
type of thing. What have you seen?
Well, I think we start out with the first big step in realization that we just can't throw money at the problem. It won't work. Then you step back from that and say, all right, we need resources with the problem. Where does that money best focus its best result? And you come back then to home and community-based programs as your front lines. They got to be developed. They got to be expanded across the state. Slow down the migration if you're able to make the savings and keep them out of the Medicaid beds. Mm-hmm. Lower that. Even if we're not able to do anything other than maintain the number, because there's almost a two-year waiting list now.
Sure.
If we can, from a human standpoint, we prevent the suffering, we come up with the solution, and we prevent the budget busting, not needing as much in the future there. So in early on in this, the first place I see is that we've got to look at more alternatives on a home and community-based basis. Then we got to go to the elements that are servicing the system, people that will not remain home. They can't remain home. It's not a viable option.
Mm-hmm.
Are there options, though, that can still keep them there? And if they're not, then how do we make things more cost-effective in what we require and do? And that will be the next level. And that's why I go into nursing homes and to residential care facilities and talk to these people about the challenges. To come in there, and if they're not making hardly any money, the money we're reimbursing for them is almost too low now to make it. And then government comes in and thinks it's raising quality by mandating increased standards, but it isn't willing to put any money into it. They're going out of business, and no public purpose is served. So we've got to develop strategies for how we keep them viable. We make sure they don't take advantage, but we've got to make them viable. And so we're trying to understand, how do you interface? Where are these requirements coming from? Do they have a reasonable relationship to the health and viability of seniors, or is it just something that has just crossed the mind of a bureaucrat?
Well, like Meals on Wheels, that's such an excellent program that could be integrated to make sure that they are getting that daily seeing somebody.
Exactly.
That makes
it's a wonderful
great
thing.
And yet Meals on Wheels is struggling a lot because of the price of gas. as far
there
as
you
volunteers
go.
Going out there and delivering the meals, yes. In our area,
yeah.
That's
well, you see, and then the price of gas, I told you it depressed the economy. It makes it harder to do things. It makes things more expensive. But Meals on Wheels and other meals programs, the senior centers that have those programs, the Not Meals on Wheels, that is one of the great things that allows those people to remain in their homes. If they remain healthy, they stay out of the emergency rooms.
Sure.
So they are struggling, but the public...
Plus somebody checking on them,
yes,
I think.
And,
you know,
well,
that human
that's part of what happens.
Yes.
That's part of what happens. Sometimes that's the only human contact they have. And these people... I met a volunteer, a veteran, who's retired today, out driving and delivering meals to people, and they view it, he's just, you ought to see the smile on their face, the welcome that
yes,
they have
exactly.
at their house for him. He also checks on them and reports back to the senior center if they're not doing well, if something's wrong. These are people who truly care. That's what South Carolina's about. We are great enough people that we can marshal the private sector, and when you asked earlier what were some of our strategies are how do we take and make the lieutenant governor's office a one stop where you can pick up the phone and call, I've got this problem, what resources are available, who can I connect with, how do we integrate the efforts of the churches
mm-hmm.
and the nonprofits in the community so that our program only comes in and it complements. If they're already providing meals, but the homemaker service is the key to them remaining in their home, then so be it. That's all we got to do. Together, we've kept them out of a $46,000 to $50,000 a year Medicaid bed.
And I think the thing that's interesting is you're saying you can do it for $1,000 a year?
Yes,
$1,000 a year per person. We're not talking about a month. We're talking about a year. That is phenomenal, Glenn.
And you're just helping them to stay in their homes. I wish... your listeners could see the faces I've seen.
I think a lot of them actually have, because we have a lot of volunteers that do Meals on Wheels
yeah.
and this type of thing. So we do have a lot.
They know. Those volunteers know what I'm talking about. Those people are out there. They are making it against incredible odds. They just need a little helping hand
yeah.
to get over the hump.
Okay.
And we can do that. And this is 50 times cheaper. Why not?
Absolutely. You are correct. Hey, let's hear a quick word from our sponsors. We've got calls all over the place. We're going to have to get to them some right now. So if you'd like to give us a call, 229-7984. That's 229-7984. We'll be right back.
Ready to race to you. These days are
this is Philip Biffle, your Greenwood Edward Jones Financial Advisor. Do you have a recovery plan for your investments? If not, there are several reasons we think you should. While interest rates are very low, certain income strategies and investments could help increase your investment income. Also, many investment portfolios are out of balance at a time when proper investment diversification may be most critical. You also may want to review your portfolio to consider replacing lower quality investments with higher quality investments that may be at attractive prices. No one can control what the market will do next. You can, however, take advantage of investment opportunities that exist today. At the same time, it is important to be well positioned for whatever the market does tomorrow. Please call me, Philip Biffle, or stop by my office today to develop your personalized recovery plan investment strategy. Please call me, Philip Biffle, at 229-0444, or stop by my office today to develop your personalized recovery plan investment strategy. Edward Jones, Making Sense of Investing, member SIPC.
Ann Eller, I'm right here with Lieutenant Glenn McConnell. We are having a good time, and we are talking about a lot of issues here. One of the issues, kind of switching from elders here, is Bob Akers called with Akers Trucking. He says he's very concerned that we aren't on the ball with the port situation. Please give people like him in the trucking business a surety that something is happening to keep us competitive.
Well, I'll address it on several different fronts. Of course, I thought DHEC giving a permit to Savannah to dig out that river and to threaten the Savannah River and the basin was a bad decision. But we moved to the Port of Charleston. The Port of Charleston, the legislature this year put the money aside in the bank to tell the federal government we're ready to dig out the Port of Charleston and make it 50 feet. So I think that's going to happen to him. They are applied for the permits. They've gone through an accelerated permit process. The other part of the port equation is the dual rail issue. Let me put this in a compact way to your listeners so they'll understand. They're building a new terminal that'll initially have three berths up in North Charleston. When they agreed to do that, they signed to port a memorandum of understanding with the city that they would send any rail traffic out of the south end of the Navy base and would not send any additional trains out of the north. Well, now the state wants to send trains out of the north. So they now have proposed a rail yard right on the Clemson University footprint of where they were going to build the Restoration Institute, which will create jobs and business for the port. So what's happened is they're now in court. In my opinion, the state, when they approved it, the Budget Control Board, there was a gentleman's agreement with the city of North Charleston that they would not go out the north. The city, to agree to that, wants some reasonable concessions. Unfortunately, the state is just adamant that it's going to go right on the Clemson footprint and go out of the north, and the state needs to recognize that if there's been a change of conditions, they can't run over the city of North Charleston. They're going to end up in litigation. I'd rather have them as our friends. They need to shift the rail yard as much as they can, which they can do, off of the Clemson footprint so Clemson University can go forward. They can get dual rail access, and let's get on with building the rail yards and the port access road, because the port is part of the economic engine of South Carolina. So to Mr. Akers, I'd say I believe it's going to occur. There's a commitment in the General Assembly to do it. I hope the state will get flexible, settle the lawsuits. We don't need to be spending money with lawyers. We need to be spending money building.
Absolutely. All right. Well, there, I certainly hope that. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize, Glenn, how important the port is to the upstate. Some people think it's only the lower state, but when you look at BMW and Greenville and all this area up here, the port is such an important issue.
It's very important. And one of the criticisms I had of the port over the year, they didn't develop break bulk, which affects industries and everything to the degree that they should have done. But it's essential here in Greenwood to the industries that are here, to Greenville. And trucking is essential to link that port to our industries. The rail issue deals more with more long-distance travel outside of South Carolina or inland ports and things of that nature. But that port is essential. And if this state is to grow, jobs, hopefully we could turn this economy around. Somebody's going to get it in their mind that energy is ultimately the thing that is the culprit here.
What about our roads and bridges?
Deteriorating. They're getting into terrible shape.
Exactly.
There, again, is an example of the yelling and over the gas tax and everything else. And where's the money going to come from, rather than facing up that we got a growing question of a deteriorating road system? More people, we need to reexamine how we finance roads. The infrastructure cannot be allowed to collapse. And it's one of those things of where people, again, need to be brought around a table. Here is the problem. All right, we got a difference of opinion on what should be done. We got to get a solution. So how do we get it? What can we do? What can you bring to the table? What are you willing to do to help us? We got to solve problems.
Absolutely.
We just can't continue to talk about problems.
That kind of goes into where I could go on to the tax system then here in the state. That is another one we keep kicking down the road, isn't it?
It is. It's the tax system. Of course, we have the of course, you get me on tax, and I get furious about the Department of Revenue because I feel like they use interpretation to expand the tax laws. You want to expand the tax law? Pass a law. It's not. Don't give me an opinion from somebody at the Department of Revenue. I don't think they constitutionally have that authority. General Assembly can't give them that authority. It's an unconstitutional delegation of the power of appropriation. And so, again, it's a case of we know we need to do something with the roads. We know we need to do something at the port. We know we need to do something on aging. You try to come up with solutions.
But there's an election in there, so we better wait till after the election, right?
That's right, because some people are looking. As soon as they get in a state office, they're looking to get to Congress or somewhere. Everybody's on the move up the ladder now. And the result is, rather than moving to the problem, and I hate to say that, but I saw it increasingly, the conflicts, the one-liners, the sound bites, mm-hmm. The world of blogging has made that to it, sound bites and one-liners, easier to happen. We've had some complex issues. I've had to face down when I was president pro tempore, enforce the Constitution to turn my back politically on it and avoid the political fight. But I go back to what Goldwater said. The first and primary issue ought to be, is it constitutional before would I like to do it? There are a lot of things I'd like to get accomplished, but we don't sometimes have the power, and it's not good to give government the power.
Overall, Glenn McConnell, you spent, what, 31 years?
31 years, yes.
What do you think of the whole experience?
I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. To sit down today and talk to John Drummond, we could recollect some of the experiences we had, some of the events that we did over the years, the learning curve, the people I've met, the people I've served with, the perspectives I've gotten. I wouldn't trade it, but I was becoming somewhat increasingly frustrated by the way the politics was going. We always had clashes in the Senate, but at the end of the day, we tried to solve a problem. Now, some people will criticize us that we don't do enough. Well, the framers didn't want us to do too much. What was so good today that could pass today was kind of in their philosophy, could wait till tomorrow. And that was kind of the way they did, because they were highly suspicious of government. But I look back, and I just I've met some wonderful people that have influenced me to get out there, to have the opportunity to confront these seniors, and to be in a position maybe to help them is a wonderful opportunity. I wouldn't have had it if I hadn't hung in there for 31 years and gotten pushed up into the lieutenant governorship.
Absolutely. And as you go forward here with the election coming up, November 6th, what do you think we're headed on the election here this year?
Where do I think?
Mm-hmm.
I think the country is going, unless something occurs in the next several weeks, I think the country's going to vote for change, a new direction. I think the price of gas is crippling the administration in Washington politically, and it should.
Absolutely.
But it should also be a message to all of them up there. They need to reverse and get a real energy policy. And the second thing is the Congress needs to take back the regulatory authority. We're in a position where EPA, for instance, could have imposed cap and trade without the U.S. Congress ever voting on it. That ought to be a ring in the head to everybody listening that they got too much power in the executive branch. A regulation has the power and effect of a law, and it's and if it can go into effect, like here in South Carolina, without a vote, we're in a dangerous situation. They can impose fees through those things. That's taking your money. That's close to taxation without representation. They call it a user fee, but it's a tax.
Absolutely. Well, Lieutenant Governor Glenn McConnell, I certainly appreciate you being here today. I know you've had a great time with your day here in Greenwood, and we certainly look forward to you coming back. Do you have any wrap-up words you'd like to give us on the face of aging?
Well, I would just say to your audience out there, support the senior centers. Help the folks that are trying to make a difference here. Volunteer. We need seniors helping seniors. If we're to get our hands around this and to work through this problem, it will take not just government, it takes volunteers, it takes seniors, it takes team effort, and as we confront it, it looks more and more like that's what it's going to take. So I would appeal to folks, listen, anything you can do to help, support them, give them money to get the meals, anything you can do, it's a wonderful cause.
Absolutely. Well, I will give you one more call. Beth Carlisle called in. She said, did you bring your own coffee with you? I understand you used to do coffee, have a coffee business and an ice cream business.
I did, but we didn't bring any coffee with us.
Darn, I love coffee, and Beth probably knows that. And she also says she likes your approach. Do you need volunteers to help?
Yeah, we do need volunteers. They need volunteers at senior centers. They need volunteers to do meals. And if they have some ideas, anybody out there has an idea, I would encourage them, please, to write us in Columbia. And let me make sure I give you the accurate information, because everything changed. But it's post office. It's still 142 Columbia 29202. That's post office box 142 Columbia SC 29202. Or you can go to lieutenantgov.sc.gov. We need your thoughts, your suggestions, and your ideas, because, it, again, this is a people problem, and that means everybody out there. We need to help.
Absolutely. And you do have telephones down there, don't you,
we do.
Glenn? What's that telephone number?
Telephone, that's a good question. It's 803-734-2080.
2080. You know, Glenn McConnell, it's been a real pleasure to meet you. Thanks so much for coming out here today.
Well, thank you.
All right.
We'll
look forward to your return. That's going to do it for us right here on WCRS 1450 AM. There'll be a podcast, and there'll be the video on the website, so make sure you check it out. That's going to do it for us. Bye-bye, everybody.